Welcome to this Touch podcast activity, which has been recorded for Touch Immunology. This podcast aims to bring you expert perspectives from a multidisciplinary team on the management of eosinophilic esophagitis, or EoE. Specialists in the MDT involved in caring for patients with EoE share their understanding of the pathophysiology of this condition, perspectives on the clinical and symptomatic burden for patients, and discuss disease management strategies, covering both dietary and pharmacological approaches. This activity is funded by an independent medical education grant from Regeneron Pharmaceuticals, Inc. and Sanofi Genzyme. This activity is jointly provided by USF Health and Touch IME. In this podcast, an allergist immunologist, a gastroenterologist, and a dietitian engage in a case-based discussion on the management of eosinophilic esophagitis, or EoE, in current practice and the potential impact of the therapeutic options on the horizon for the management of this disease.
Hello, my name is Professor Jonathan Spergel. I'm a Professor of Pediatrics at the Pullman School of Medicine and Chief of the Allergy Section of the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia in the United States. I'm joined today by Professor Arjun Brednanor, who's consultant gastroenterologist at the Amsterdam University Medical Center and Professor of Neurogastroenterology and Motility at the University of Amsterdam in the Netherlands. I'm also joined by Dr. Isabel Scapala, consultant allergy dietitian at Royal Brompton and Herefield NHS Foundation Trust in the London, UK, and a clinical lead of the Adult Food Allergy Service. In this section, we'll look at the management of eosinophilic esophagitis in current practice and therapeutic options in the horizon for our patients. We'll start by reviewing a patient. Our patient is sort of a classic story of EoE. He's a 33-year-old male with a history of allergies, of rhinitis and asthma, and a long family history of allergies and asthma. He presents in the A&E with a food impaction, and over the last 5 years, his dysphagia has gotten worse, had more heartburn, has begun to change his eating habits by reducing eating of solids, and it's beginning to affect his mood and his social life. His endoscopy is relatively classic, showing edema and exudates and having esophageal eosinophilia. So I'm going to start off our first panel discussion with a question to Dr. Brednanor. What should our treatment goals be? Do we need to look at symptoms, pathology, endoscopy, or a little bit of everything?
Yeah, this is of course key when you before you start to treat a patient. What are your treatment objectives? And I think in EoE, this is similar to many chronic diseases that you cannot cure, which is of course one of the treatment objectives is to treat symptoms. That's very obvious. And the other one is to prevent the occurrence of complications at the long run. And in EoE, we do this by treating inflammation, by getting the patient into histological remission, with the idea of that this will stop the formation of fibrosis and stop the risk of long-term complications such as strictures and more food impactions.
So now we sort of know where we want to be with our treatment. So we have various treatment options. We have steroids, we have diets, we have dilatations, and we have biologics in the future. And so Dr. Scapala, as a dietitian, when you think of diet, do you pick one diet over another, or how do you manage your patients in terms of diet and nutritional aspects?
So thank you for that question. I think originally people were excluding six foods, but they found that is a very restrictive diet. And what we do now in practice, certainly in our clinic, is to suggest that patients avoid either milk and wheat, or just milk or just wheat, as these are the two foods that seem to be very common triggers. And if that's not effective, we can consider then stepping up to four food elimination to add in exclusion of eggs and legumes as well. But we have to remember that, you know, it's very hard, especially for young adults, to keep to a diet. Sometimes it's a really difficult option for them. But we do know that if it can be done, it does give very good remission from symptoms. But often adherence is a problem.
Here's the problem in everything we do in medicine, whether we give medicine or diet. So this is the perfect time to lead to Dr. Bredener. So when someone fails diet or doesn't want to do diet, what options do you talk about?
Yeah, with families? Roughly there's two classes of medicine left. That's the proton pump inhibitors. And the other class is the topical corticosteroids. The proton pump inhibitors, products like omeprazole or pantoprazole, they lead to symptomatic remission of about 50% and also a histologic remission of about 50%. So they are reasonably effective. And there are oral medications with relatively okay side effect profile. The topical corticosteroids are also in many countries still used off-label. And there's liquid formulations or dispersible formulations of budesonide available, or sometimes the fluticasone is recommended, but then spray and swallow instructions. Now these drugs work, there's a big range of how effective they are, and that depends on the formulation. The spray and swallow doesn't seem to be that effective. About 30 to 50% of the patients get into remission, while the oral dispersible seem more effective. These medicines are taken twice a day.
So, and I was just going to ask, but I think it's more of a deposition problem than a medicine problem between the two medicines, just how well it coats. And do you, I'm curious that you do it twice a day, because often we try to get it because of the compliance issues that Dr. Kapala talked about before. We also try to get our patients down to once a day, and it really try to always get to the lowest dose. Do you ever go down to once a day instead of twice a day?
Yeah, so the question is what when is the adherence better? If you recommend twice a day, will they take it once a day, and are you pleased with that? If you recommend once a day, are they taking it every other day or less? So I don't know what's the best approach. We certainly know from recent research that the adherence is really poor, and about 40 to 50% of the patients has a poor adherence.
So I'm going to bring this back to diet for a second before we go on to future therapies. Dr. Scapala, when you think about diet, do you ever let patients cheat? Because it's different than IgE-mated food allergies. When they cheat, they have anaphylaxis. Here they cheat, they have made symptoms a little while. We used to give pediatric patients, let them on their birthday have a birthday cake or something. Like, okay, you can cheat one day and not the help with compliance, or let them have baked goods and not have regular milk. Do you do anything like that at all?
Yeah, we do tend to leave it up to the patients. And when we get them to exclude these foods and reintroduce them, I always tell them to reintroduce different wheat products or different products containing milk separately, because often they will report that they can tolerate, for example, milk, but they can't have cheese, or the other way around. And I do think it's important to find a diet that is right for them, because if we're wanting them to continue this diet in the long term, it needs to be very specific, I feel, to the patient and their needs. And we have to remember, some of them will also be avoiding other foods such as fruits or vegetables or nuts, because they often have a pollen-related food allergy, which can also restrict the diet. So I think you have to look at the whole person and tailor the diet to them.
Great. Now, I think about what's coming next is all the biologics. And I know in the allergy field, several of these biologics are recently available, such as dupilumab, mepolizumab, rezolizumab, so things blocking the IL-4 receptor, blocking IL-5. And we recently looked at some of our patients who were on dupilumab for their asthma and atopic dermatitis, and looked at what happened to their EOE, and not surprisingly, consistent with the phase 3 data, that these patients got better. So using these patients who have asthma and atopic dermatitis, using the biologics for those reasons, their EoE got better. And so we're hopeful as these drugs come along, and there's several that are in various clinical trials, that things will get better. So I'm curious, Dr. Bredenow, when you think about using these biologics, and if the phase two and phase three trials continue to look, how do you place them in there? In their study, in terms of treatment, in your now treatment paradigm?
Yes, this becomes an important issue. I personally think that, mainly because of cost issues, the biologics will probably be used as a second line therapy. So if either the PPIs or the topical corticosteroids fail, or patients have side effects or intolerant, in those cases, the monoclonal antibodies will be used. Of course, it differs a bit in US and in Europe. And that's because in Europe, there are products available, approved. While in the US, there's currently no approved topical corticosteroid. And on the other hand, it would be strange to withhold a labeled medicine and recommending an off-label medicine first. So I'm not sure how that's going to develop.
Yeah, and I also think for a lot of our patients who have concurrent asthma and atopic dermatitis, in theories, which as we saw with our papers, that, hey, now I'm giving one medicine and I'm treating multiple diseases. And I'm not a medicine financial person, so I don't know what the corporate cost, the cost to the insurance and medical course, but using some of these biologics, potentially treating multiple atopic diseases, may be beneficial, because a lot of these patients have so much concurrent disease, and it looks like these medicines might work in more for one patient for multiple diseases, maybe particularly useful.
Yeah, definitely. That will be a factor of importance. And also, if these medicine are able to prevent progression to a fibrostenotic disease that will require dilatations with endoscopy and sedation, the cost factor may be different.
Yeah, I think that's a great question, because I don't think we have any. That question is going to take time to answer, because it's going to be a long-term issue. And the other question I would almost have to Dr. Scapala is, do you think once we have these biologics and going back to dietary therapy, you think we might be able to expand some of these patients' diets on biological therapy?
I certainly think so, though in my experience, a lot of adult patients are quite keen to use a diet rather than drugs. It depends a lot, I find, on the age. The younger men often prefer the drug treatments. That dietary manipulation is much too difficult. But I think a lot of the time we have to go with, if the patient wants to try diet first. But I certainly think it would be very helpful if there could be a way of using both to maximize the diet, but also the social life and eating out and all of those things, if the biologics can help as well.
All right. So, Dr. Bredenow, we started with Martin, a 33-year-old with EoE. What would you recommend? What would you recommend for Martin after our discussion? Where would you start? What would be your first option?
Yeah. Well, I think I'll go for the shared decision making and offer him the three options, being PPI, topical corticosteroid, or a referral to an expert dietitian for dietary guidance.
So Dr. Scapala, now the patient presents to you, what diet would you give? What diet would you say Martin wants to try diet? What diet would you start with?
Well, I would probably suggest wheat and milk together to exclude that 6 to 8 weeks and reintroduce. If, however, his social life did not fit in with that, then maybe just excluding them sequentially, so one and then the other. And just review at the end of that.
In the United States, we tend to, when we can, some patients don't want to do it, but we, for the reasons that Dr. Bredenow mentioned, we recommend getting endoscopy with biopsy, because we really want to see what's going on, because patients have all this modified behaviors and they don't realize they're symptomatic or they have disease. So we, when we can, we want that patient to get, as we talked at the beginning, to get symptoms better, histology better, and endoscopy better. So when we can, we do recommend getting some pieces of tissue until we have a non-invasive marker, which we hopefully will be available sometime in the future. So again, thank you so much for the interesting conversation.
Thank you for listening to this Touch podcast. You can access more content on this topic at www.touchimmunology.com. Don't forget, there are two other chapters in this series, so please listen in for further insights from the multidisciplinary team. This activity is part of a Touch curriculum of activities on EOE to be released on Touch Immunology during 2022, including a Touch Congress, which is available now, and forthcoming Touch panel discussion and Touch expert opinions.